Good day. All sites are now on the conference line in a listen-only mode. If you're experiencing technical difficulties at any point during the conference, please press the star and zero on your touchtone phone, and an operator will assist you. And at this time, I would like to turn the program over to your host for this afternoon, Ms. Joyce E. Hirth.
Thank you, and welcome, everyone, to our conference call series on enhancing services in natural environments. These calls are sponsored by the OSEP Community of Practice on Settings or Natural Environments, facilitated by the National Early Childhood TA Center, NECTAC, and the Southeast Regional Resource Center. Our team of facilitators includes Linda Fletcher, myself, Cal Black, Sharon Ringwald at NECTAC, and Liz Jackson, Delia Serpa at CERC. Today, our presenter is Dr. Robin McWilliams. Linda, why don't you introduce Robin for us?
All right. It's my privilege today to introduce Dr. Robin McWilliams. He is currently at Vanderbilt University in the Department of Pediatrics at the Medical Center, and he is director of the Center for Child Development and a professor of pediatrics and a professor of special education. He's provided over the years services to young children and their families in an inclusive setting. He's conducted research and provides national and international training to early intervention personnel and administrators. He has many publications in journals and textbooks that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. His model of strategies for providing early intervention services in natural environments has been implemented in many communities across the country. And his material that once was disseminated through Project Integrate now is done through the outreach services on the Center for Child Development at Vanderbilt University. And those websites where you can access materials and more information about Robin are on the call page for today's call. So, Robin, we're very pleased to have you, and go right ahead with your presentation.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for that introduction, Linda. It's very hard to follow a short, pithy, humorous introduction, so thank you for sparing me that. That was a joke. Now, I'm going to start then on moving to slide two, which is a sort of template slide for organizing the content of my material. I should say at this point that what I'm talking about is a model of strategies that I can't claim are all original. But what we have found is a package of strategies that together make a lot of sense from the beginning through the beginning of a child and family entering Part C through the delivery of services. And so the components of that model are the ECO map, which you can see is listed under gathering information from families, the routines-based interview, which is used for gathering information, as well as it has a role in evaluation and assessment, as I'll explain. It also leads to the IFSP. It's the process that we use for developing an IFSP. So that's the first two components are the ECO map and the routines-based interview. The third component is the use of a primary service provider model, also known as transdisciplinary service delivery. The fourth component of the model is support-based home visits. And because many children are also in some kind of group care, the fifth component is integrated specialized services to classrooms. And I'm using classrooms in a broad sense to include child care. So I'm going to proceed with that general framework of moving through these five components of the model. So moving to slide number three, we see a quick look at an eco map. If you're clicking along, you'll see that this PowerPoint is organized, that different lines or pictures appear in sequence. So a quick look at an eco map. If you click again, you'll then see the picture. On this slide number three, we have a completed eco map. This is typically done during intake. By whoever is doing the intake visit. And it's used as a way of getting the family talking about the family. We find that in a lot of intake visits, people go in with a lot of information to provide the family, which of course is appropriate because part of what we're doing is explaining what the early intervention program is about. But when we asked families how much they retained, how much information they retained from the intake visit, we found that a lot of them said, well, she was a real nice lady and I liked her red shoes. But we didn't hear that they had retained a lot of the actual content that had been provided. So we've been interested in trying to figure out a way to get some useful information from us, but more importantly, I think, to give providers some structure for getting the family to talk about what they're doing without a checklist method. Families are often grilled during intake visits when we're trying to get some social or medical history. But I'm not quite sure why we ask some of those questions. I'll give you an example from early in my career. I remember I used to have to ask families, mothers, whether they smoked during their pregnancy. Well, what do I care? That's not going to make any difference in the interventions that I provide and the support that I provide. In fact, I think that kind of question is designed purely to be able to pass judgment on the mother. So what we're interested in is actually functional information that will make a difference in our interventions. And so the EcoMap, finally I'm getting back to the EcoMap, the first area that we ask about is the immediate family. So here we find out that we have Kevin and Sarah, who are the parents, and their daughter Michelle, who's 24 months, and she's the child who is in early intervention. They don't have any other children, or they would also be listed in this middle box. So that's the first information that we get. Then I typically ask about the mother's parents. So we see that there are maternal grandparents, and so we put them in a box above the nuclear family. And this is followed up by some questions such as, how often do you talk to your parents, Sarah? And when good things happen with Michelle, who do you tend to call first? And she might mention her mother, for example. So with a few questions like that, we get the idea that that the maternal grandparents provide quite a lot of support to the family. So that's why we put in this thick line that you see going from the nuclear family to the maternal grandparents. And you can see some other family and friends across the top. That's the informal support network. You will notice that there are different thicknesses of lines, and the thin lines, which we can see at the bottom, that lead to Kevin's work colleagues, SLP consult and PT consult, are for people who the family knows but doesn't really have much of a relationship with. The thick lines, as I mentioned earlier, are the people that do provide a lot of support, and the medium-sized lines are for those who provide more than minimal but less than maximal support. The dotted lines are for people who are a source of stress. So in this particular case, this was a real family, by the way, Sarah did not like her pediatrician because even though the pediatrician was probably competent, like with many parents, Sarah was especially concerned about the fact that he didn't seem to listen to her, and so she just didn't like this pediatrician. You'll notice that the paternal grandparents have a moderate line and a dotted line. The dotted line, remember, provides is a source of stress. And you can have both, because what happened in this case was that the paternal grandparents did some babysitting of Michelle, so that was some support to the family. But also Kevin's mother tried to tell Sarah how to raise Michelle, and Sarah didn't appreciate that. So the babysitting came with a cost. So the formal support network, which is service providers, go underneath the family. And then what's become very important are the intermediate supports, which are on the sides. And intermediate supports are work and church, temple, synagogue, mosque, whatever it is. Increasingly in America, sad to say, our work friends are often our sources of support and are our friends, and that is really often very true. And then you see that church in this family is a moderate support to the family. And so we ask families whether they participate in any religious activities, and we just ask them straight out whether they do. And if they don't, then we don't put anything in there. No judgment is implied. And this leads me to a point about how this is done. And I know I'm spending quite a lot of time on the eco map, but it's because it's making some other general points that I'll come back to. And a major one here is this is an interactive process between an early interventionist of some kind and the family. And it all depends on the style that's used to do this. If the person goes in there with a friendly style that quickly establishes trust with the family is going to be very happy to participate in drawing this picture. If somebody goes in and does and grills the family in a checklist sort of fashion, then the family is not going to be as trusting of what's going on here. The way we introduce this, by the way, is to say that I'm going to ask you some questions about who all is involved with your family, so that then when if your child is enrolled in the program, then when we make suggestions, that it makes sense for the context that your child and family live in. Or we use some kind of words like that to explain why it is that we're asking these questions. Okay, I'm going to move on now, and then if you have more questions about the ego map, you can ask them later. The next major component, and in many ways this is the backbone of it, and it is certainly the component that has received the most attention, the routines-based interview. This is used in a widespread way in a number of states, and many local programs are using it. In the routines-based interview, the first thing that happens during this interview is that families report on their routines. I'm just going to walk through the structure, and then I'll provide the rationale a little bit. Families report on their routines first. Next, staff report on classroom routines second. So if the child is in some kind of group care, then the daycare provider, let's say, would report on how the child does during the classroom routines. Third, specialists ask questions and provide information during discussions of routines. In other words, specialists such as OTs, PTs, speech-language pathologists, early childhood special educators, don't have a time where they give a report from their domain. The point of the routines-based interview is that the organization of the conversation is routines, not domains. Fourth, staff withhold giving advice. This is an important point in the interview, because the minute we start trying to solve a family's problems with them or for them, we step into the expert role and they step into the consumer role, and where they are listening to us trying to tell them what to do or making suggestions. And it changes the balance of power. And what we want to happen during the routines-based interview is this is a time for us to gather information from the family. And if they directly ask us, well, do you have any suggestions about what I could do about this problem, we say, yes, let me write down what your question is, and our team will be sure to get back with you to come up with some solutions with you about this. So we take it seriously, and we have to remember to follow up, but we don't succumb to the easy temptation to give advice. Many of us in this field are nice, helping people and want to give advice, but it's a dangerous thing to do during the RBI, as people call it. Let me just, before moving on to slide number five, say that the routines-based interview is typically done after eligibility has been established, after eligibility has been established. So one point that many people seem to forget is that if a child is enters the system with an established condition and therefore is automatically eligible for Part C services, there might not be a need for any testing to be done. This is a state and sometimes local decision whether to do any testing, but it's not necessary for eligibility. It may be that somebody says it's necessary because that's the kind of information you want to put under current level of functioning. But if a child is coming in under established condition, then we can go to straight to a routines-based interview, and I'll address the issue about whether we can provide descriptions of the five required domains off the RBI a little later. If a child is coming into the Part C system with suspected delay, then in most states some kind of testing is going to have to be done to see whether the child meets the criteria in that state for eligibility under delay. So either way, in most cases the RBI is going to be done after we've determined that the child is eligible. So then somebody might ask, well, what's the point of having another assessment then? Well, the point really is that the testing for delay does not necessarily give us functional goals to work on. I know that there are some tests and some developers of tests in our field who claim that their instruments really do, but my point is that the instruments that tests are decontextualized. That is, they ask whether kids can do stuff. They don't ask what are the demands of a child's daily life and how well is the child functioning relative to those demands. And so the routines-based interview could be thought of as an assessment of function as opposed to of ability, and it is also a needs assessment. So it helps to identify, helps the family identify where it is that they have needs as opposed to what the child can and cannot do. So as the family goes through their routines, and it begins with whoever you're interviewing, whichever parent you're interviewing, you say, how does your day begin? And for each routine, which is not, the routines are not predetermined. Every family has its own way of running its life. And so the way we move from one routine to another is to say, and what happens next? I will give a definition of a routine at this point, and that is a routine is an activity or event that happens with some regularity in a family. So it is not a specific way of doing things. Some people will say we need to go into a family and establish routines. Well, that's another definition of routines. When I use the term routines, I'm just talking about chunks of the day, events that happen, like getting up, getting dressed, diaper change, having breakfast, getting ready to go out of the house, being in the car, hanging out in front of the TV, you know, just times of the day. For classroom programs, if the kid is in some kind of a childcare program, then the routines are what you would typically find on the classroom schedule, such as arrival, circle time, sand and water play, centers, and so on. Okay, so during this interview, what do we ask about? And now I'm proceeding through slide number 5. By the way, at this rate, we'll be on this call till about 5 p.m. Okay, so the first question is, what does everyone else do? What we've tried to find out first is what are the demands of this routine? What are the other family members doing? Secondly, what does the child do? And so, and then the third is, how satisfied is the caregiver? But I'm going to come back to that. When you're trying to find out what the child does during this routine, there are three areas that we have found to be very useful that are not the traditional domains of development. And if you click on and move to slide 6, you'll see that the first sort of domain that we're interested in is the child's engagement. And this has to do with the child's participation in the routine. How busy are they? Are they following the, are they doing the kinds of things that are expected or hoped for in the routine? So at breakfast time, is the child eating and drinking and communicating with the family and looking at what's going on around and so on? or is the kid just sitting there zoning out or unable to do anything, non-engaged? The second area is independence. Many families are interested in independence in their children, especially Western families. We do have to be careful to be culturally compatible when it comes to independence, because not all cultural groups value independence the same way. And the third area is social relationships, and this covers social and emotional behaviors, appropriate behaviors, communication, and getting along with others. And we stick all of this together into this general area of social relationships. And at this point, I will make the point that we don't necessarily use these jargony terms like engagement and social relationships, but we ask questions that get at these areas. So to recap the information that we ask about in the routines, we ask what everyone else does, what does this child do? Specifically, how much does the child participate and in what way does the child participate? How independently does the child do things in the routine? And what are the social relationships like during the routine? And then perhaps the most important question of all, after getting all of that description, is to the family, is there anything about this routine you'd like to, about this time of day that you'd like to change? Or how happy are you with it? Or some question that gets at the family's satisfaction with that routine. I will discuss a little later the point that we are now exploring satisfaction with routines as a proxy for quality of life with families. That if we can help families be satisfied with their daily routines, we're probably doing a good thing for them. And then for the classroom routines, the question isn't, is the teacher satisfied with what the child is doing, but it's how good a fit is the routine for the child. So if a child continuously gets up from circle time wanders off, and therefore is non-engaged during circle time, we would probably say that was not a good fit. That's the sort of the equivalent of the satisfaction question for classroom routines. I'm moving on to slide number 7 now, and this is has some information about the scale for assessment of family enjoyment within routines, SAFER. We spend more time trying to come up with the acronyms for our scales than we do the items. The SAFER is a way of getting a score for the family's satisfaction with their routines. So for each routine, we ask the family on a scale from 1 to 10, in some versions of it it says 1 to 5, how satisfied are you with this routine? And that's how we keep track of whether families' quality of life, as measured by this instrument, is improving. And the SAFER is available from our website. The SAFER, as I said, I'm on slide number 8 now, does measure family quality of life, we think. It also provides some guiding questions for follow-up. We find that people who've been in the field for more than about 10 minutes are actually able to ask around about family routines, but we've been surprised that there are some people in early intervention who don't really know how families live and don't know the appropriate questions to ask around different routines, and so we've reluctantly provided some guiding questions, and we just pray that people don't actually read the questions but use them as a guide. I'm now moving on to number 9, but before I go through number 9, let me just make sure you understand how the RBI really works. This is one or two people. Well, I recommend that it be two early interventionists sitting down with a family. How many members of the family there are is up to the family to figure out. And you go through sitting down with the family and the child care provider, if possible. Which is not always possible to have the person there at that time, but you go through the discussion of the routines using the structure that I've given you, and I will say that when it's done well, the family is somewhat unaware of what all the details are, the 6 questions that you ask within the routines. They just think that we're having a really interesting conversation about how the child does during daily activities. Then the interviewer, the main interviewer, goes back and reminds the parent of areas of concern that were addressed during the conversation. And now I'm going to give you some a useful tool that you might want to write this down, and that is the RBI report form. This is a form that we have recently developed for helping providers keep up with the information during the interview and then to document where the needs were and which domains of development were addressed. We didn't used to have such a form, but we found out that, you know, even though early interventionists hate paperwork, you can't get them to do a damn thing unless you give them a form. So we gave them a form. The RBI report form provides a structure for the interview for those people who find that helpful. All right, so after reviewing the areas of concern with the family that have come up during the routines, we then say to the family, okay, now that I've just reminded you of the things that you mentioned, what would you like to work on? And this is the part that is really, this is the process is great for the RBI, and most families love it. But here is where we get the product, and that is the list of priorities for the family. So, as I said, the facilitator or interviewer reads aloud notes about potential problem areas. The family selects, it says on this slide 4 to 8 outcomes, but I put up an old slide. We actually end up with 6 to 10 outcomes now. We find that this is a lot more than a lot of Part C programs tend to have, but then we've done research on the quality of IFSPs and have found them often to be poor. And one of the ways in which they're poor is that they're often so general we don't really know what we're working on. So the RBI produces, the family comes up with a list of things that are much more concrete than you find on a lot of typical IFSPs, and that's why there are more of them, and it tends to be 6 to 10. Then when the family just lists whatever the things are that they think are important to work on, and then we ask them to put these into priority order. I often say, this isn't true, but if we only had time to work on one of these, which would you want it to be? And then I say, okay, now what would be the second and third and so on? As you can imagine, most parents end up putting their own concerns low on the priority list. But we do insist that they tell us what this order is, and then we always list the outcomes in that order from that point onwards. I'm moving on to slide number 10 now, the RBI and outcome functionality. The routines-based interview does lead to more functional outcomes, meaning that they specify what the child or family will do, and the contextual need has been identified. That is, it tells you what makes it functional, the context in which, where the goal is needed. Also, the RBI reflects goals that are important to primary caregivers. It's their priorities that are ending up on the RBI, of course. We have data to support the functionality of the RBI, by the way, and that's because we use a scale called the McWilliams Scale of Goal Functionality, and this is a method for rating any outcome on this 1 to 5 scale, 5 being the functional and 1 being non-functional. So if you're interested in that scale, also be sure to look for it on our website. Next on, what slide is this? Must be slide 11. Our Elliott's family's outcomes. This is a real list from a real family that I did an interview with. And it gives you an idea on the left-hand column of the original words from the notes that I took when I interviewed the family. And these were the words that the family saw written down on the piece of paper that I was doing it right in front of them, of course, and that they put into this order. So the first one was moving on stuff outside and inside, such as going upstairs. In other words, some kind of gross motory type of goal. Second was textures outside. 3, why not eating more for eating a variety of foods and so on. You'll see that that they were restated into outcome form, and this may not be exactly how I would have worded it, but this is goal writing by committee. The people at the workshop came to this consensus. Elliot will play, for the first outcome, Elliot will play with movement on three pieces of equipment for 5 minutes each, so he participates more. There are a couple of components to this that you might pay close attention to. One is that I am obsessed with measurement, and so even though we have an extremely functional, family-friendly way of coming up with outcomes, I do believe that we shouldn't be able to measure them, which, of course, pleases the policymakers because that's what they want, too. So we discussed with the family what it would take for them to be convinced that the child had made good progress in that area and arrive at a suitable criterion. And it also has the in order to or so that statement in here. So you see on the first one we have Elliot playing on pieces of equipment, and so you ask why, who cares? And it's so he can participate more. was what the parent really was concerned about. They didn't really care too much about whether he could play on the playground equipment. It was that it wasn't just the motor movements the parent was concerned about. It was that when they went to the park or outside or wherever, that he actually could do something there. To give you another example, textures outside gets translated into outcome form as Elliot will play in the sandbox or move on the grass, because those were the two areas that the parent had said were a problem, for 10 minutes, three times in a row, again, so he participates more. You'll notice that both of those are engagement goals, and the way you know that is because it says participation. So you can see some other examples of the move of the translation from the original words into the outcome form, always preserving what it was that the family really wanted. Okay, now I'm moving on to slide number 12, which is a very important slide for understanding where we're coming from with this model. Traditionally, in early intervention, those of us who entered the field 80 years ago thought that what this was about was professional support that would lead to child progress. Well, it turned out that it ain't that simple, and that we can't make a lot of difference in our intermittent contacts with children. Seeing children for a few minutes a week, you know, even an hour or 4 hours or something a week, is not going to make an appreciable difference to the child. Children are making their progress as documented by improvements in their developmental trajectories or by their acquisition of important functional skills because of what regular caregivers do with them. Children don't learn through blasts or injections of treatment. They learn through ongoing, repeated interactions with their environment, and of course the people who are eliciting those are the regular caregivers. So, in the home context, the model rests on the premise that if we help families become competent and confident in what they're doing with their children, that will lead to child progress because they're maximizing the learning opportunities for the child. And the method that we are promoting for enhancing families' competence and confidence is transdisciplinary home visits. The other side of the model has to do with children who are spending time in classroom programs such as childcare. And here the key is getting the regular teaching staff to embed interventions through the daily routine. So it's the equivalent of having families maximize learning opportunities. Both of them are maximizing learning opportunities. And the way to get classroom staff to do that, to embed their interventions, is to use an integrated therapy approach, not to go pulling kids out so that the teachers don't know what the heck to do. So you can see that in this model, our work, since we are extremely interested in getting documented child progress, is we have to work in a competent and proper manner with the regular caregivers, and that would be the family, and if the child has teachers, the teachers also. So now we move into how do we do this? And so I'm going to talk about transdisciplinary service delivery, which I know other speakers have talked on these calls have addressed also. We need a method that emphasizes how children really learn. We understand that children do not learn through lessons. Little kids don't learn through lessons. We need a plan that's unified around the family's functional needs, which is why the RBI is so helpful. And we need to capitalize on families forming close relationships with a primary service provider. This is taken from research that shows over and over again that families do form close relationships with their home visitors. The good news is that they form close relationships with their home visitors. The bad news is they form close relationships with their home visitors even when the home visitors do crappy services. So we know that we can't just take family satisfaction as our entire guide for what we're doing, but we do have to capitalize on the fact that many home visitors are really good at forming relationships with families. Fourth, we need to use specialists as efficiently as possible. In many parts of the country, there are shortages of pediatric OTs, PTs, and speech-language pathologists. And we know that in most parts of the country they're expensive. So we have to make sure that we're using the allied health professionals as efficiently as possible. Fifth, we need to use our limited resources most effectively. And I am amazed in states where you have multiple people going into the homes, multiple people going into one home in 1 week, at how unbelievably expensive that is when you start multiplying that across all the children in Part C who are getting multiple home visitors in a week, and how unnecessary that really is. On the concept that most parents are competent people and that helping families to be maximally competent and confident doesn't require a whole bunch of different people going in there, I just think how much more good we could do if we would allocate our resources so that the families who need more can get more and the families who can do very well with one primary service provider are getting one primary service provider. So let me talk about the primary service provider model. I'm on slide 14 now. This is the same as transdisciplinary. And Geneva Woodruff, who is the second speaker in this series, gets on my case all the time for chickening out of using transdisciplinary. And really the reason for that is that there are a number of providers who have a strong reaction against the term transdisciplinary. So Melissa Sheldon and Dathan Rush, who've also spoken on this series, and I and others have been using primary service provider model as a substitute. One person works with the family weekly. Now, there's some different interpretations and different models have different ideas about how frequent these visits should be, but I really think that when you consider all of the complexities of ways of supporting families with children in the Part C program, that I can't imagine how we could provide all that support if we weren't didn't have contact with them weekly. Other professionals provide services through joint home visits with the primary service provider. In our model, we are promoting this idea, even though we know that sometimes you have to do some creative work because of reimbursement. In some states, it's very hard to get reimbursement for two people going to the home at the same time. So sometimes you can only charge for half the time. Each person can only charge for half the time. In other states, interestingly, they both can charge for the full hour if that's how much time they spend there. But the joint home visit is a very important part of the primary service provider model in my model. And it's to ensure that the primary person is actually hearing the same message that the family's hearing. Because after all, when the specialist isn't there the next week, the primary service provider's job is to support the family in carrying out that specialist's program. And I hope you notice the way I phrase that, support the family in carrying out that specialist's program. The primary service provider is not providing therapy, unless he or she is a therapist. The benefits of the primary service provider model, slide 15, the family receives strong support from one person, not having to get to know multiple people, and the data show that the more people the family has to get to know, the less support they feel from any one of them. Secondly, the program for the child and family is coordinated and not fragmented by domains or disciplines. Third, weekly, the family has to host only one visit in the home, not multiple visits. And for those of us who have children with disabilities, as I do, I think you can sympathize. Fourth, service providers, especially therapists, can serve more families. This is a really important point given shortages and the cost of specialized services. Fifth, the cost of the system is reduced, as I've mentioned earlier. The sixth point is that the expected outcomes of using a primary service provider model are that the child outcomes we expect are going to be the same whether you do primary service provider or multidisciplinary, but the outcomes for the family are very much likely to be better in the primary service provider model. And an important point is that the costs are lower per family. Not that I think we should spend less on early intervention, I just think we have to redistribute the costs. Okay, on the 16th slide, we have a flow chart for how service decisions could be made. We asked first, what are routines like? That would be the routines-based interview. And then that leads to what does the family want to work on? You remember that they make that decision, which is the outcomes. Those outcomes, once we know the outcomes, then we have to make a decision what model of service delivery are we providing in this program or for this family. If we follow a multidisciplinary model, then we have to ask what services are needed to address the outcomes. Now, you notice that we don't make this decision until after we have the outcomes. This is a point that we find over and over again gets violated in many places, and that is in many places they find out that the child has delays in, let's say, motor and speech, and so we get a PT and a speech-language pathologist involved, and we decide, okay, this kid's going to get PT and speech, and we make that service decision before we even know what the outcomes are. And then, guess what kind of outcomes we end up with? Well, whatever the PT and the speech therapist suggested, even though those might not be the actual priorities for the family. So we need to really force people to follow what the order that is written in the law, and that is that we decide on outcomes and then we decide on what the services are. So in a multidisciplinary model, we decide what services are needed to address the outcomes, and we put those services on the IFSP. If we follow a transdisciplinary model, we have to ask who is likely to be the primary service provider, and that can be based on a number of criteria, such as who else is serving a family in that area, do we have a service provider who knows a lot about this type of disability, or do we have somebody who's of the same culture as the family, and so on. So you make your decision about who's likely to be the primary service provider. And then the question is, what help does the primary service provider need for each outcome? Because if the primary service provider can take care of helping the family with learning opportunities or interventions for that goal, then we might not need a bunch extra services. But if the primary service provider needs help in helping the family, then we will need to decide on on additional services. And so it's at that point that services then get put onto the IFSP. Now, I'm going to go fairly quickly through home-based integrated services consultative work with childcare. In home-based integrated services, we need an alternative to dumping. I'm on slide 17. We need an alternative to dumping a clinic-based model on the living room floor. This is, you know, years and years ago when I actually actually worked for a living and made home visits. This is what I did. I went into the home with my toy bag and I dumped the toys on the. No, well, I didn't. I was very careful about selecting the toys that came out. And I basically could have been working in a clinic for all the good I was doing. I was basically working directly with the child, with my materials, and this is basically a clinic-based model. And so we need an alternative to that, and I should imagine by now that the reasons are obvious. I think that you've probably had discussions before on what's wrong with the toy bag. The third point about home-based integrated services is that we need to attend to the complex interrelated needs of developing children and their families. I've heard Mary Beth Bruder say before, good home visiting isn't rocket science, it's harder, and I think I know what she means. Fourth, we can achieve these by having support as the goal of services. And so what we're interested in the support-based home visits is attending to emotional, material, and informational support. On slide 18, you will see that in emotional support, we found out through a qualitative study that we did some years ago that there are five characteristics of emotional support that are meaningful to families and that lead to good outcomes. Being positive to and about the family and child, the parents and child. Being responsive, being oriented. In material support, this involves making sure that family has all the equipment and materials that they need, so that's specialized equipment and just basic materials, diapers, formula, shelter, clothing, and that they have information to and access to financial resources. And one of the good news pieces of one of the good things that's happened in early intervention has been the sophistication of service coordination that means that material support is provided better than in the days when I made home visits. Informational support. Families want information about child development, about the child's disability, about services and resources, and what to do with the child. In fact, that last one is about 80% of what it is that we end up doing with families, is giving them information about what to do with the child. So whereas before you might have thought that teaching a family how to feed their child was providing speech therapy or occupational therapy, I'm suggesting that we should say that this is providing families with support, specifically informational support, and specifically what to do with the child. In other words, in this model, we're recasting the work that we do with families as support. Almost anything we do with families becomes a form of support, and a lot of it is on that very last one, what to do with the child. On slide number 19, I won't go through this. You can read this for yourself, but we realize that we have to provide an agenda for people when we take away the crutch of the toy bag. And here are some, here's an agenda that replaces using the toys in your toy bag as the home visit agenda. I believe slide 20 continues that. It says Toy Bags Anonymous because we understand that people do have an addiction to the toy bag, and so I'm going to become rich and famous one day when I develop my 12-step program for dealing with that addiction. So now let me just finish up with the classroom-based integrated services. This is based on research that we did that where we were looking at, this is slide 21, models of service delivery to children in classroom-based programs. And we saw that there are essentially six models that can be provided. Individual pullout, which you'll be familiar with because it's the most commonly used one in the United States according to our data. Small group pullout, you know what that is. And one-on-one in class, this is where somebody goes and takes the child over to the side. The integrated models include group activities where the visitor to the classroom, the early interventionist, does something with a bunch of kids, but for the purpose of the individual child on the caseload. Individualized within routines, which is where the person joins the child in what the child is already engaged in and weaves in the interventions or learning opportunities into the child's ongoing play or activity. And then pure consultation, where a person just observes and gives recommendations to the teacher. Our data showed that individualized within routines was the most effective in terms of Battelle improvement, that is developmental improvement as measured by the Battelle, and acquisition of outcomes. And we found that the individual pullout and small group pullout were not effective. And the reason, of course, is because there's no carryover into the non-therapy or non-early intervention time. And the beauty of the individualized within routines model is that you're doing the work right there where the teaching staff can see how to do it in the context of their own routines. And also it allows the visitor to the classroom, the early interventionist, to see how things are done in the classroom, which then makes the recommendations and the interventions that much more compatible with the context. Slide 22 has to do with key ingredients of successful integrated services. Communication. There is four times as much communication that goes on when you use an in-class model compared to an out-of-class model. It is important to establish ground rules, such as when I come to the classroom to see you, it's you I'm coming to see. This is you talking to the teaching staff. I'm not just coming to work with Johnny. So we need to make sure that we pay attention to each other and talk to each other when I come to the classroom. At the same time, it's important to be humble and to engage in sucking up behaviors so that the person sees that the consultant to the classroom is willing to do the dirty work. Regardless of the model, whether even if for some reason you're pulling the child out, which of course violates any evidence that we have for effectiveness, communicate with the teacher. And then use a routines-based assessment to have functional goals. We have found through our individualizing inclusion project, which is another project I have, that the more functional the goals are, the more embedded intervention occurs. And that, of course, makes sense. Use collaborative, not expert consultation. So we need to decide on the needs and the solutions together with the teaching staff, not just give them recommendations about what to do. Slide 23. Here we have some definitions of key terms. On the eco map, you see that it's a graphic representation of the family. You can read that one. Slide 24 is a key definition for the routines-based assessment. You'll see that it's what happens in existing routines, how the child performs during routines, and the family satisfaction. And the next slide, 25, is the definition of a routine, which I gave you earlier. Slide 26, I hope you're keeping up with this, is the routines-based interview. And I will say that this is a standardized approach, and I've had to start saying that because there are people who say that they're doing a routines-based interview when all they're doing is some kind of general conversation around what your typical day is like. And we think it's helpful for people to understand that the routines-based interview actually does have rules about how it's done. And, in fact, we have a manual called the Family-Centered Intervention Planning, and that manual is also available from the material section of our website. Primary service provider model I've just recently described to you. This is slide 27. On slide 28, we have services and interventions. This is a very important slide. This is understanding that there's a distinction between these two things, that services is what professionals provide to caregivers, and interventions is what regular caregivers provide to children, such as learning opportunities. So the question is, what's more important, maximum services or maximum intervention? And most people would say what's really important is maximum intervention. We want the kids to learn. And so to get more learning opportunities, do we necessarily need to have more services? And the answer is no, we don't. Support-based home visits, you can see the definition here falls under focusing on emotional, material, and informational support. Integrating specialized services, here I've given a definition of the individualized within routines approach that I told you is the most effective. So, some key principles and supporting research. Go ahead and move on to slide number 32, just because we're coming close to the end of my didactic time here. The principles. One is all the intervention occurs between specialist visits. When people can understand that it's what happens when we're not there that's really important, then they start paying attention to, okay, well, then what do I really need to do when I am there? And the second one is therapy and instruction are not tennis lessons. Kids don't learn in lessons where they then have to generalize their information to the non-therapy time. they're simply not wired to be able to do that yet. They're not old enough. This is what older kids can do. Third, regular caregivers need to own the goals so that, this is especially important for classroom teachers, with parents, we find that they will say that they participated in the development of the IFSP, but then we see that quite often they don't actually implement the stuff that's on it, because it was so general that it doesn't have the meaning for them that it should have had. On slide 33, you can see a graphic for who has how much influence on what, and this shows that increasing caregiver competence and confidence is probably our key to enhancing child outcomes. How children learn is through repeated, this is slide 34, is through repeated interactions with the environment dispersed over time. They do not learn in massed trials, although some massed trial practice can be helpful for children. And then slide 35 shows what happens in home visits. We have the home visit with the family, and between these home visits is when family-child interactions and other learning opportunities occur, and that's where child learning happens. I then conclude with some top 10 must-reads, which has embarrassingly too many things by me in it, but then I'm my favorite author. You'll notice some of the other luminaries in the field. I was nice enough to include them in this list. So that they might be helpful to you. I do, on slide 39, have some information about the kind of training that I provide. I do have a project for training on inclusion, but then I also do a lot of work around the country on natural environments, and you can see some details for that there. So that was my last slide, number 39. And at that point, I'm done.
Robin, thank you very much. I wish you could hear the laughter, but when we're all on mute, of course, you're playing to a quiet audience.
Okay.
But thank you. And let me just also mention, I had one of the comments on evaluation about people doing a plug for their training at the end. People are doing that because we ask them very specifically to let people know what kind of training is available and how they can access training. So, well, thank you very much for doing that for us.
Yeah.
And now, Kevin, would you give the audience instructions for queuing up for questions?
Absolutely. And at this time, if you would like to register your site for a question or a comment, please press the star and one on your touch tone phone. If you wish to withdraw your question for any reason, press the pound key. And it appears that our first question comes from Mary Zaremba in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Hello, Robin.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good.
I wanted to ask you a question. If you could elaborate a bit on slide 26, you state that the RBI can be a clinical experience for families. Would you discuss that?
Yes. Let's see, 26. Right. I'll give you an example. Last week, I did an RBI in New Orleans, and when we were done with the interview, the parent then talked to her regular service provider, and she said a number of things. She said, you know, even though you people are really nice to me, this is the first time that anybody really sounded like they cared about my whole family, including the siblings, from the minute we wake up until the minute we go to sleep. Secondly, we have some data from one state in this from one state that when they started using the RBI, their no-shows for IFSP meetings went down. In other words, the families not only did the families were they there for the IFSP meetings, but they actually said, when do we get to do this again? And then the third point I wanted to make around this clinical experience is that quite often families get emotional when they're talking about this, and when you realize we're just asking them about, you know, kind of what goes on through the day, you'd think that's a fairly, neutral activity. But when families are really talking about their day-to-day lives with their kids, it can be quite emotional for everybody. And back to my parent from New Orleans last week, the word that she used was that it was a cleansing experience. So That's what I meant, Mary.
Excellent. And what reminds me of, Robin, too, is that I think all of us need to remind ourselves that when we are in conversation with families, that the conversation itself can be an intervention.
Yes, that's a very good point. And for those of you listening to this, Mary and I know each other, so the interview takes a while. It can take about an hour and a half on average. And so for people who say that, well, that's a big expense of time, well, yeah, but it may be a big expense of time, but the intervention value with the parents is huge.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay.
And our next question comes from Deb Garnell in Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi, my question is around the SAFER. I was trying, as you were speaking, to download it and to see if I could look at it, and also to have get an understanding of what the RBI looks like. So are we able to access those?
On my website, especially if you go to the National Individualizing Preschool Inclusion Project part of it, and let me give you that website's address. I can't remember if it's on the NECTEC sheet that was provided, or the Communities of Practice sheet, but here is the address, www.individualizinginclusion, one word, individualizinginclusion.us. If you go in there and go to the materials or the instrument section, you will see sample pages from the SAFER and the RBI form. And then on the materials page, you can actually order the thing.
Okay. Well, we do have those websites listed on the call support page.
Okay.
And our next question comes from Cindy Driscoll in St. Petersburg, Florida.
The question that I have is related to slide 15, when you talked about benefits of the PSP model, and the part that you talked a lot about was expected outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, since we are so quantitatively focused, as in most professions, and, you know, I hope this one is qualitative, just kind of putting it aside there, is what gauge are you measuring these outcomes, or is it based on family satisfaction, or there isn't part in the model that we're expected to do that?
The family satisfaction, as I mentioned before, is necessary perhaps, but not sufficient. So I'm not just limiting it to family satisfaction. So the outcomes that we are interested in, different programs, of course, will have their own measures of child performance. What we are using in our trainings is progress on outcomes as measured with an instrument called the TGIF, as in Thank God It's Friday, but it actually stands for Therapy Goals Information Form, TGIF. And this measures the child's progress in terms of independence and frequency. Yeah, independence and frequency are for each child-level outcome. We also have numerous measures of child engagement, which we consider to be a very important outcome. For family outcomes, in some of our work, we're using the Family Empowerment Scale, and the SAFER, because that measures what we think is a proxy for family quality of life. All of these are quantitative measures, by the way. Let's see, on family outcomes. That's probably enough to be going on with, but the point on this slide number 15 was that however you measure them, we think that the PSP is no worse for children and is definitely better for families. But in our model, when people want information on measurement of these outcomes, this is what we have to provide.
Thank you.
Okay.
And our next question comes from Helen Keith of Burlington, Vermont.
Hi, Robin.
Hi, Helen. It's good to hear you.
This isn't Helen. My name's Marinelle Newton. I saw you at a conference in Marlboro, Mass.
Yes.
Last summer, and I saw you do the routine-based interview in one of the workshops. I was wondering if you have a video example for us visual learners.
Yes. Larry Adelman, who, if I remember rightly, is actually the next speaker. Was kind enough to make a videotape of an interview that I did in Colorado, and this videotape goes all over the place showing me doing an interview. And so you can order that tape from us, again from our website. It's listed on the materials page. And then I have a number of other lesser quality video examples, but I will tell you from a training point of view, for those of you who are involved in training out there, is nothing beats a live demonstration if you can do that.
Thank you.
Okay.
And our next question comes from Heather Higgins in Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi, Robin. I had a question about the use of the routines-based interview. We work with a lot of families, and every once in a while we run across families where, I hate to say, but it's like pulling teeth sometimes to get them to carry over those interventions in their home, and they tend to kind of eliminate services from their family that require more participation from them and hang on to the ones where therapists and interventionists are working with their children. Have you found that using the routines-based interview engages that family more to make the outcomes more successful?
Yes, because when you're doing assessment that is focused on how can we make your life better for you, talking to the parents, then we end up with outcomes that will in fact do that. And so so that's the first part of it. Then, you know, once they've decided on what they want to happen, then the second part is, well, how much do you want to do? And you're saying that there are some families who, you know, who don't want to or can't engage in the level of interventions. But the first step is, are we actually talking to the family about things that they really care about? And so the routines-based interview definitely helps with that. And you also bring up another good point, is that there are some families whose lives are so full of having to deal with other priorities that they're really not finding lots of time and energy to engage in learning opportunities with their children. And so then I think it's very reasonable to ask them if they would like other people to be doing that. In other words, to suggest whether the whether childcare might be an option or some other kind of setting. Because most parents do want their kids to be able to do good stuff. They just might not be able to do it themselves.
Right, and we can probably find that through a good interview with the family, find out maybe ahead of time that this is the type of family that won't be able to carry out those interventions.
Right, and another thing is that if you've done the eco map, you can often have a better sense of whether there are people in the family's informal support network who can help give the child more of those experiences that the family is unable to do.
Right, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and our next question comes from Terry Nowak in Lexington, Kentucky.
Hello, Robin McWilliam. This is actually Christy Lunsford, and I'm here at the site where Terry is.
Hi, Christy.
I'm at the University of Kentucky, and actually my question is in regards to the PSP model. I actually used the video that you were referring to earlier with a group of primary service coordinators, as we have here in Kentucky, and the video I thought was excellent, but their concern was that it demonstrated in a very clinical setting, and it wasn't in the home. It wasn't very realistic to how the RBI would be conducted, with lots of things going on and interruptions and that sort of thing. And they also wanted to know, you know, exactly how long did this seem to take, given an estimate of a time. And you did provide that information. I think you said it was about an hour and a half.
Right.
To conduct that information. And so I guess my question would be, you know, how do you anticipate or feel like we could encourage the PSP, if you will, to buy into this, and that it is a more friendly type of an interview that's very realistic and not just by the set of, like you said, by the set of rules and regulations program, that it's something that really conveys that you're interested in the family, and it works for the service coordinators. I know they like the format that you have, the form that you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that they would have to have that in order to conduct this interview, something to write it down on.
Right. Okay, stop there, Christy. You've raised so many points, I won't be able to deal with them all. Okay, so the first one is, yes, in the natural environment, the routines-based interview can be full of interruptions. Dogs barking, drug dealers walking through the house, children crying, all kinds of things can be happening. So the difference then is, compared to what is done in a distraction-free kind of environment, is that you have to stop and start many times. And so there isn't quite as much flow. But we encourage people to say to the family, you know, we're only going to do this twice a year, because most programs opt to do it at the IFSB and the review time. And if there's any way we can have uninterrupted time, that would be great. And some families can arrange that and others can't. So, you know, you're taking your chances. But we do actually ask them, because it's only twice a year that we make that request of them. So that's the point about the interruptions. Secondly, it is a friendly atmosphere. I'll tell you that it's actually a friendly atmosphere even when you're doing it in a conference room full of 100 people. from the family's point of view, the families just love it. They don't care. If it's done right, they love it. The third point is about buy-in. And this has to do with actually a lot of the parts of the model. Is if you're going to wait around for buy-in from people who are reluctant to do any of this, good luck. We'll be talking 10 years from now having the same conversation. I really think that at some point, either individual providers need to make a commitment to it and go for it, and that is buy-in, of course. But also program administrators might need to use policy. And they might need to say, you know, this is something that we need to be doing here. From now on, we're going to start doing it. Because, as I said earlier, if people are reluctant to do it, they'll find all kinds of reasons not to, some very good reasons not to. So just be careful not to hope for too much buy-in. But on the positive side, if you want people to have buy-in, the way to do it is to demonstrate it live. There's nothing better than the live demonstration. It's much better even than the videotape, but I'm grateful as all get out for the videotape. But
right.
Yeah.
Okay. We are too. We were very glad to have that piece, and you're right. We're going to do some more training on this, and I believe we'll have to do a demonstration of using that. And
get Leanne Young in Kentucky to do a demonstration.
Yes. She's the one who gave you the video. Thank you.
Okay.
And our next question comes from the site of Glenda Rogers in Oklahoma City.
Hi, Robin. My question is, when you're referring to the primary service provider model, and you keep referring to the primary service provider and then the therapist, would you tell me what the qualifications are, who are the primary service providers, what their qualifications are?
The primary service provider can be a person from a qualified early interventionist from any discipline. So I know I do tend to use primary service provider and therapist as though they were different, but a therapist can be a primary service provider. I will tell you that in the modified transdisciplinary model that I find myself talking to states and programs about a lot, most of the primary service providers end up being generalists. That would be people with backgrounds in child development, psychology, education, early childhood special ed, and so on. With the medical allied health professionals, OTs, PTs, and speech therapists, spending more of their time doing joint home visits as consultants to the primary people, and that's purely from a financial standpoint. So I will tell you, for those of you who are interested in cost models related to the primary service provider, I do have information about that, and I have different models for showing how you would allocate people's time depending on how much they cost and what their discipline is for different places. So I've rambled on a bit with my answer, but...
thank you. That answers my question. I would be interested in the cost model, so...
Okay.
How do I just send you an email, or...
Yes. For those of you... Is my email somewhere, Joycey?
On your side, I think.
Yeah, I think so. If it's not, we'll put it there this afternoon. I think it's with your bio information, Robin.
Okay.
Thank you.
Robin, if there's an easy way of figuring out how people can find out about those cost models, maybe we can place that up as a handout on the site for later follow-up, because I think several people would be interested.
Okay, I'll try to do that. It'll be a bit cursory, but then people can follow up with questions.
Okie doke.
And once again, if you would like to register your site for a question or a comment, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. And our next question comes from Mandy Perdue in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Yes, Kim Kimbrough is joining me for this call, and the question is hers.
Hi, Robin from Shreveport and Payback Association.
Hi.
Enjoyed your presentation, but I'm sure you're up to date on this. Anna has recently implemented, and my question would be around your primary service provider model. Does that person who represents any discipline become the family service coordinator?
That's in a way an entirely different question, but very relevant. In states that have a dedicated service coordinator model, the service coordinator does just that, and then other providers, as they're often called, end up doing the ongoing services. And so in a dedicated service provider state, the primary service provider would probably not be the service coordinator, because service coordinators in those states have huge caseloads, and all they do, so to speak, is process IFSPs and some other service coordination activities. In states that allow the primary service provider to be the service coordinator, then yes, it is usually the primary service provider who is, in fact, the service coordinator, the one and the same. And that, according to Carl Dunst, probably talked about this last week, but that is the model that appears to be the strongest model for service coordination, is when it's the same person. Did I answer your question, Mandy? Or whoever's question it was?
Yes. And that was my my issue, was mm-hmm. that Louisiana does have a dedicated system of family service coordination.
Yes, I know.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, well, so does Tennessee.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Lana Faust in Manhattan, Kansas.
Yes. I wondered under what circumstances you would consider mass trials to be effective.
Well, under almost no circumstances are they effective by themselves. But you know what it's like when a little kid learns a new skill, and how they sort of have, you know, you can't stop them from doing it. So whether we're talking about a baby who's just learned the joys of peekaboo, and the kid wants you to do it over and over and over and over again. The theory is that there probably is some developmental gain from those repeated rapid-fire kinds of practice things that the kid is doing. But that wouldn't be the, you know, I wouldn't just do peekaboo in a repeated fashion once a week, for example. So they still need to be dispersed. But there are, in the early childhood years, very few, I can't think of any offhand reasons for teaching a masked trial approach by itself.
Unless it was child-initiated, it sounds like.
Yeah, or child-sustained.
Yes, thank you.
We want to thank Robin. Our time is up. And Robin, thank you very, very much for an excellent call. And thank you all for joining us.